Sonia, isn't it? I pressed. The injured girl? You wanted to show me how easy it would be for me to wind up like her. How easy it would be for another fighter to beat me. He raised his head, his gaze boring into me. His eyes were red-rimmed and his face, even clouded with hurt, was devastatingly handsome. Yes. His admission should have filled me with anger, but it didn't. Maybe it was because in that moment he reminded me so much of how Mal, with his ridiculous overprotectedness, used to treat me sometimes. It wasn't that Kai didn't think I could handle myself, but he worried about me all the same. I hadn't been imagining things the night of the oath-taking. Kai cared about me. He shifted again on the bed, clearly uncomfortable, and stifled a groan. I poured him a cup of cool water. He gulped it down, thirstily, and when I reached for the empty cup to take it back, he circled my forearm with his long fingers. I was wrong, you know, he said. Your wrists aren't weak. Nothing about you is.
Decurion.
Kai.
Kai.
His hand ran up the length of my arm, then drifted upward to rest against the side of my face. His palm was warm and I found myself leaning into his touch before I could stop myself.
I've never known anyone like you, he whispered.
Ever.
Since that moment on the ship.
The moment when I tried to kill you? No. The one when you put yourself at risk to help Charon. The man who'd put you in slave irons, in the middle of all that chaos and death. You are uncommon in your bravery, Fallon. You are stronger than any woman I've ever known.
He smiled ruefully.
And you seem determined to haunt my dreams.
I stood abruptly, feeling my heart pounding in my throat. If Kai had been a slave, even if he'd been a simple merchant or tradesman, it would have been different. How laughable for a once princess of the Khantii to even think such things. There was a time when he wouldn't have been near good enough for me. Now he was so far above my station as to be in the stars. To even allow myself to be swept away on the tides of my imagination was madness.
Fallon. Kai pushed himself stiffly to his feet and took a step toward me. Look at me.
I did. I shouldn't have.
Embers of desire flared in his hazel eyes, and suddenly all of my reasoned arguments as to why this should never, could never, happen, fell silent. A roaring silence muffled the voices in my head, telling me to turn around, leave, don't look back. He was close enough to take me in his arms, if he wanted to. But he didn't.
This can go no further,
I said in a choked whisper.
We both know.
Kai pulled me tightly to his bandaged chest and held me there, even though I knew it must have hurt him to do it. I looked up at him, and he kissed me with a hungry desperation that tore the breath from my lungs. His hands tangled in my hair, and my arms tightened around him. He hissed in pain, or pleasure, I couldn't tell which, but he didn't stop kissing me. Not for a long, dizzying while. No one had ever kissed me like that before, not even Mal. I didn't know anyone could kiss me like that. It seemed as if time stopped in that moment and everything I'd gone through, every hardship and horror that had led me to where I was, had been worth it for this. For him. But then, I felt his hands brush the iron slave collar I still wore around my neck. I heard the whisper scrape of his soldier's calluses on the raw metal and pulled away from his kiss.
Kai's eyes were shut, his chest heaving.
Kai, I breathed. My lips tingled from his kiss. He opened his eyes and cradled my face, holding me so that I couldn't look away.
I ask you again. I'm begging you. Will you let me buy your contract, Fallon?
He asked in a fierce whisper. I swallowed hard again and shook my head.
No, Decurion. I will not.
Kai dropped his hands and stepped away from me. Then he turned, bending to retrieve his tunic from where it lay on the cot. He stood with his back to me for a long, aching moment, and his expression, when he turned back, was once more remote.
It was as if he'd closed a heavy door and shut himself away from me.
"So be it," he said. "Then you should know that one of my missives from Caesar to your Lannister was this. You and the other seasoned girls are to go on the circuit starting in 3 days' time."
"The circuit?"
"A tour of the regional arenas outside of Rome." He looked at me, the flaring passion in his gaze buried beneath an ashen layer of pain. "Caesar and some of the other senators are sponsoring a circuit of gladiatorial bouts leading up to his quadruple triumph. He wants the gladiatrices to create names for themselves before they appear in his triumph events. At the end of the circuit, Caesar will choose one gladiatrix to perform in the role of victory in a reenactment of his conquest of Britannia." I thought of Nyx and how there must be others like her at the other Ludi. Girls who were just as competitive, willing to do almost anything to win a role like that. The competition would be fierce and dangerous, perhaps even deadly. "So," Kai continued, "as a gladiatrix of the Ludus Aculea, you will go and you will fight. You'll probably survive. Perhaps you'll even survive unscathed. Maybe you'll make a name for yourself." He looked over to the rumpled cot where Antonia had been convalescing. From where I stood, I could see that there were rust-colored stains on the edges of the sheet. "Or maybe you'll wind up like her.
You tell me I'm so strong, and yet you don't really believe it." I shook my head. "You don't believe in me."
"Of course I do. But there's strength, and then there's stubbornness. Recklessness. You think you need to prove something. To whom, Fallon?" His gaze burned my skin. "To me? To the Lannister? To Caesar himself, maybe? Do you really care what a bloody-minded tyrant thinks of you?"
"I'm not going to fight for Caesar, Kai," I said, adamant. "If I'm going to fight, I'm going to fight for me. No one else. Because that's the only honorable thing left for me to do."
"Honor is nothing but a dangerous lie, Fallon," he said. "In battle, there is no honor."
"Not really. Caesar never won because he was honorable. He isn't. He won because he was clever and tenacious and used whatever means necessary.
Just like you did today."
"I didn't. You cheated.
And you won. And here's a piece of advice." He gripped me by the shoulders hard, and his next words sounded more like a warning than advice. "The next time someone offers you an advantage in a fight, a shield, a better sword, an opening for a cheat, or a moment of weakness in your opponent, do yourself a favor. Stuff your high-minded sensibilities and take it. Your adversary might not be so noble as you, and your honor will only wind up getting you killed."
Chapter 22. My small act of rebellion, the refusal to have my slave collar removed, did not go unnoticed. One sweltering afternoon, Saoirse tracked me down after the other girls had drifted off to the baths or dining hall, finding me alone in the weapons shed as I filed the burrs from my practice blade with a metal rasp.
"We have body servants here at the Ludus, you know," she snapped by way of greeting. "Baths, barbers, clean tunics in the quartermaster's stores. A blacksmith, several in fact, all perfectly capable of cutting that collar off your neck."
"I shouldn't think you'd want to get rid of it," I said, as she stalked circles around me.
"After all, wasn't it part of my outrageous purchase price?"
"Don't be a brat. I could force you."
"Of course you could,"
I shrugged and returned to the task at hand.
"You own me."
"That's not how I treat my girls, and that's not how they treat themselves. Not if they want to win."
She stopped pacing and picked up an oilcloth, holding out her hand for my sword. I gave it to her, and she wiped the filings carefully from the blade, checked the smoothness of the edge with her thumb, and placed the sword back on the rack with the others.
"You are as much the weapon as the blade you wield, Fallon," she said.
"And you need to start taking care of yourself the same way you take care of your equipment, or you'll be of no use in a fight when that day finally comes."
I glared up at her. but I had to admit that Sorsha had a point. I'd been pushing myself hard on the training ground. Too hard. By the end of each day, I was often so exhausted that I would forego the bathhouse so that I could simply collapse on the pallet in my cell. I think part of me reasoned that if my body was tired enough, I would fall asleep regardless of the thoughts that galloped like runaway horses inside my head. Thoughts of Caius Varro and Malgun Ironhand. Thoughts of my father and of home and how I'd never see those green shores again. I blinked back the tears I refused to shed in front of my sister. When was the last time you had your hair trimmed? Sorsha asked me in a gentler tone. I glanced up at her. What does it matter? Come with me. She turned on her sandal heel and stalked out of the shed, leaving me no choice but to follow her across the practice yard and through the breezeways that led to her private accommodations. Once inside her chambers, Sorsha sat me at a bench in front of a cosmetics vanity. A floor-to-ceiling tapestry hung on the wall of the room. It depicted the moment when the Greek hero Achilles defeated and killed the Amazon queen Penthesilea, her blood woven from bright crimson threads. I guess that was how they'd come to name the first two gladiatrix ludi, after that epic struggle between heroes. Sorsha fetched a comb and a pair of silver shears and worked through the tangled mess of my hair with ungentle tugs of the comb. I sat there glowering, arms crossed. After she was through torturing my scalp, she picked up the shears. You've become such a shaggy thing, like one of those ponies you use to drive to exhaustion, Sorsha muttered as she snipped away at my neglected tresses. It's an absolute wonder Caius Varro has taken such a shine to you. My jaw dropped open. Don't deny it, she said. I've never seen him asked to spar with any of the other girls at the Ludus. Perhaps the Decurion respects my skills in the arena, I said stiffly. The arena had best be the only place he's encountered your skills, she said, and her reflection raised an eyebrow at me. I mean it, Fallon. It's one of the strictest rules we have here at the Ludus. I have no use for a gladiatrix who's lost her wits to lovesickness. I haven't! Good, she nodded, then paused. Why ever not? Sorsha! I only mean that he's kind, rich, from a powerful family, and not unhandsome. I wouldn't ever allow it, of course, but I'd at least understand. She stopped snipping and regarded me seriously for a long moment. You're not pining for a boy from home, are you? Malgun Ironhand. I know you two are close, but Mal's dead. Sorsha fell silent. She'd grown up with Mal and Aiden, too. I'm sorry to hear that. What happened? I closed my eyes and could picture the fog-bound lane from that night, but not Mal's face. The Rico gave me away to someone else. My next words dropped, leaden from my lips. They fought. Mal lost. Did you love this other boy? No. I couldn't bring myself to tell her that the other boy had been Aiden. Then why would father do such a thing? Sorsha frowned. Because I wanted to join his war band, and he didn't want me to fight and die like you. I glowered at her reflection. Like he thought you had. She laid down the scissors and lifted my hair off my shoulders, smoothing it down my back. I'm sorry to hear it, Fallon. Truly. And I wouldn't have allowed it if I'd been there. Well, you weren't, I said. Her reflection gazed at me for a long moment, cool and appraising. Finally, she seemed to come to a decision about something. I'm going into the capital tomorrow morning to take possession of 6 new chariot ponies, she said. Telestris is too busy with the younger girl's training, and Kronos and I will need an extra hand. I was going to take Nyx, but I want you to come with me instead. And while we're there, I want to show you something that might help you understand. Now go. Meet us at the stables at daybreak. Don't be late. Help me understand what? I wondered. The next morning, Sorsha turned a corner off a bustling street near where we had left our wagon at a stable close to the Circus Maximus. She led me down a narrow lane, Kronos following close behind us, until it dead-ended in front of a small, squat residence, an unassuming structure with only a single heavy door and no windows. Sorsha tugged on a rope hanging by the door, sounding a bell on the other side of the featureless wall. After a long moment, a small square opened behind a metal grate, and a man peered out. When he saw my sister, he closed the door again without a word, and I heard the sounds of lock and key and of a heavy slide bar grating as it was hauled aside. The heavy oak door swung inward, and Sorsha nodded for me to precede her inside. The man who'd opened it was armored like a legionnaire, but he was older and battle-scarred.
"Lady," he said to my sister in a voice like a boot heel crunching gravel, "he's not expecting you."
"I know." "Is he well?" The man shrugged bulky shoulders.
"Is he ever?"
Kronos waited by the gate as the man gestured us across a tiny courtyard, open to the sky, to where he unlocked another heavy iron-bound door and let us through into the dim vestibule of the interior building. The only source of light came from a few torches set in wall sconces. Unlike most of the Roman houses I'd been in up to that point, there were no windows here, no airy colonnades, no natural light. The room was long and narrow. In the far corner, at the opposite end from where we stood, I could see a brazier glowing, but it did little to illuminate the figure that sat hunched and wrapped in a cloak on a low couch. I glanced at Sorsha, who put a firm hand on my shoulder and walked me forward. "My lord," she called out softly as we approached. The figure didn't move. "My lord," she called out again, louder this time. "Arvir Argus." "Arvir Argus," I thought. "No. No, that can't be him." But it was. The man the Romans had called Vercinga Torix, the godlike chieftain of the Averni, who'd come within a hand's breadth of beating Julius Caesar himself, sat with his arms resting on his knees, long hands hanging limply in front of him. He stared into the fire, and there wasn't even a flicker in his eyes to indicate he knew we were there. "They used to keep him in the Tullianum," Sorsha said in a low murmur. "It's a prison here in Rome, a dreadful subterranean place. But when it started to look as though he might actually die there, they moved him to this place, a cage with some comforts, but still a cage." "Why keep him alive all these years?" I whispered. "Because there hasn't been a proper triumph since Alesia." "But why didn't Caesar just kill him there, on the battlefield?" "Because Caesar is a shrewd conquering hero," she said. "And Alesia is very far away from Rome. Remember what your fight masters have told you, Fallon. It's what you've been training for all these weeks. The mob loves spectacle above all else, and Caesar plans to give them exactly that. He's kept his greatest adversary alive so that, when the time came for his triumphs, he could parade Arvir Argus in front of the plebs to show the people how fearsome the Averni chief was, to remind them why they need Caesar to lead and protect them." I glanced back toward the corner. "He doesn't look very fearsome." "He will. They will dress Arvir Argus up and chain him to a stake. They'll probably get him good and roaring drunk, and then they'll trot him through the town on a cart decked with the spoils of war and the shields of the fallen."
"And then?"
"Then they'll take him to the prison and strangle him out of sight, where no one needs to see him die like an animal." Those words struck me like a physical blow. I had grown up worshipping the handsome, fiery Arvir Argus. He'd been my hero almost as much as Sorsha, and to see him as he was now, with the fire leached from his soul. "Caesar asked me to come here to visit him," Sorsha murmured to me, "as a comfort. Someone who knew him as he was, someone to talk to. And so I've come every few months for the last 4 years," she said. "Sometimes we talk. Mostly he sits there silently and drinks."
"Why would Caesar ask you to do that?"
I asked. To remind me that he could have done the same to me. Or to father, if he'd so desired. That he still could. I glanced at her, but her eyes were fixed on the figure by the fire. But I also think he grew to admire Arvir Argus, she said. Even as he sought to destroy him. My visits are a small mercy, though. Sometimes I wonder if my presence makes it better for him or worse. She tightened her grip on my shoulder. Come now, greet the king. The closer we got, the heavier the stink of stale wine. Saoirse crouched down in front of Arvir Argus and took his hands gently in her own. I've brought someone to see you, Lord, she said softly. You knew her when she was a little girl. You taught her swordplay, like you taught me. He blinked just a little, and his gaze searched the darkness in front of him until it found my sister's face.
Did I?
He muttered, half to himself.
Did I?
I nodded.
In Dorovenum, when I was small.
His eyes shifted, blinking and bleary, to focus on me.
Bright little thing,
he murmured. He beckoned me closer with a clumsy wave, and I knelt before him. His breath was foul, but I could still see, in the angles of his face beneath a tangle of overgrown beard, the hero I'd worshipped as a child. He squinted at me.
Fallon. I tried to smile at him. That's right.
She is a gladiatrix now, Saoirse said.
Gladiatrix.
Arvir Argus murmured again. He lifted a shaking hand to my cheek.
I am so sorry, bright little thing.
For what, Lord? I asked, my voice small and lost in the dim air. His words caught in his throat as he answered.
For not making the world a place where you could choose to fight for yourself.
I glanced at Saoirse, who bit her lip and looked away.
But you did,
I said, turning back to the Averni king and remembering when he was a prince and my hero. When I was little, you didn't just teach me how to hold a sword. You taught me that the fight is in here. I put a hand on my heart, my voice growing stronger. And that it was up to me to decide how and when to use it. I saw what was left of Elysia. When you surrendered to Caesar, it was because there was nothing left to fight for. But the fight itself was more important than the loss. You will be remembered as a hero, my lord, and that is at least as important as being one. Tears spilled from his eyes, and before I could say anything else, he pulled me to his chest, wrapping me in a fierce embrace. When he pushed me away, finally, it seemed as though the tears had washed away some of the fog from his gaze.
Talk to me, Fallon, he said. It has been so long. Tell me of yourself.
Saoirse retreated to the far end of the room with the guard, leaving us alone for a little while. Arvir Argus was lucid for most of our conversation, which surprised me, considering the amount of wine he imbibed. Even in that short time, he asked me how I had come to be in Rome. His eyes flicked over to Saoirse when I told him I was now owned by the Ludis Acalia, but he didn't say anything. I didn't belabor the point. Saoirse was the only friend he'd had in his captivity, and I wasn't about to air my resentment in front of him. When he asked me about the upcoming circuit, I felt the heat of shame creep into my cheeks. The girls of the Ludis Acalia would be competing for a lead role in the triumphs. The very same celebrations that would see Arvir Argus paraded through the streets of Rome to be put to death. But the Arverni king was a strategist first and foremost, and he brushed aside talk of his own impending fate to counsel me on mine. A role like that'll carry a hefty purse if you win, he grunted thoughtfully, scratching at his beard. I don't care about the money, I scoffed. Ah? Arvir Argus peered at me through bloodshot eyes. Why not? Everybody else in the Republic does. I have my honor, I lifted my chin. I won't dress up as some silly spirit of victory and fight for Caesar like a trained ape.
I would.
I gaped at him.
I've learned a few things over the years, Fallon, he said. I told you I was sorry about the world I left behind when I surrendered to Caesar. And I am. You say there was nothing more for me to fight for, and you were right. But you can't change the ways of the world if you're no longer a part of it.
I frowned.
In your case, money makes you a part of it, he explained with a grin. The favor of Caesar makes you a bigger part of it. The ability to one day rid yourself of that collar and all it stands for makes you a force to be reckoned with. Think about that, Fallon. Be an idealist, by all means, but be a pragmatic one.
You think I should fight for Caesar?
I think you should fight for yourself, he said. But those things needn't be exclusive. Temper passion with control, conviction with cunning. Win, Fallon, the way I didn't.
His fingers fumbled as he reached for the wine jug, almost spilling it. I took it from him and poured another measure into his cup. He nodded his thanks and drank deeply.
In the arena, he continued, it won't be enough just to fight your best. It's never enough to simply win the battle. What you have to win is their hearts. Caesar's heart. Charm them, beguile them, seduce the mob. That'll make him fall in love with you. Because unless Caesar loves you, you cannot truly claim victory.
I heard the sound of someone discreetly clearing her throat, and I looked up to see that Saoirse had returned. She nodded toward the door. Arviragus grunted, tossing the rest of the wine down his throat in one gulp, and waved for me to go with her. My heart hurt at the thought of never seeing him alive again. As I turned to leave, he called out to me one last time.
Be brave, gladiatrix, he said, and be wary. Bright things beget treachery. Beautiful things breed envy. Once you win Caesar's love, you'll earn his enemies' hate. The Morrigan keep you, Arviragus, I said.
He laughed at that.
She won't have much choice soon.
As Kronos drove me and Saoirse back to the Ludus Achillea, I watched the 6 new chariot horses trotting behind us down the road, tethered on a line. They seemed to me to be creatures that embodied the perfect balance between spirited and obedient. Passion and control, like Arviragus had said. I turned to Saoirse.
Why did you take me to see him?
To show you why I did what I did, she said. To help you understand why I came here to Rome and fought for Caesar and never went home again.
You did it because of Arviragus?
No, she shook her head.
I did it because of Father.
And you?
I don't understand.
I wasn't captured, Fallon, Saoirse exclaimed.
Of course she was captured. My sister wouldn't have surrendered. Ever.
She sighed. When I left the Rovinum for the last time, she continued, I knew I wouldn't ever go back. I had Olon cast the auguries for my fortune, and they told me so unequivocally. I thought it was because I would die in battle, but that wasn't it. There was a battle, to be sure. It began that evening and carried on into the night, and Caesar saw me fighting in the field. He discovered who I was and understood why I was there, to free Father.
I always thought I would one day die on a battlefield, because Olon told me that I would share the same fate as you, I said.
I thought you lost the fight, Saoirse. We all did. We thought you were dead and that Caesar only decided to release Verrico after the other Pridane king sued for peace.
That's what he wanted you to believe. A thin, crooked grin bent her mouth. But the truth was that Caesar had already agreed to release Verrico
long before.
Why would he ever do that? I scoffed.
Caesar had sent a message to me secretly, she said. He is a brilliant commander in the field, but he's also a shrewd opportunist in his civilian life. He already owned massive stables of gladiators and made rich sums of money off them. That night, when he saw me, a woman of the Cantii, fighting on the battlefield as fiercely as any man, he saw the opportunity to birth a new phenomenon, female gladiators. I didn't know why my sister ever would have agreed to such a thing. We made a deal, Fallon, Saoirse said, sensing my unasked question. My life for Verico's, my servitude for his freedom. Verico would live, and live free, and you would grow up with our father, there for you. She nodded down the lane toward Aviragus's prison. You see what captivity does to the soul of a man like that. I couldn't let that happen to father, so I made a deal with a demon. I'd do it again. She lapsed into silence. For the rest of the journey back to the Ludus, I thought about Aviragus and Verico and the sacrifices my sister had made and continued to make for me. Was it possible I had been so wrong about my own sister? I needed to find a way to make amends. On my way to my barrack cell, I cut across the deserted practice yard of the place that had somehow become my home. As I reached the center of the sand circle, I felt a strange, dizzying sensation and heard the sound of wings beating overhead. I looked up, and the sky was clear. Empty. But in my mind, a throaty voice whispered, "Daughter," and "Victory." I felt my cheeks flush. Freedom. I began to worry that the Morrigan had turned her favor from me, but her voice in my head told me she was still with me, and it seemed she had a message, one that I finally understood. Aviragus had been right. The role of victory carried with it the promise of a substantial purse, but it had never even occurred to me that I would find a pure use for filthy Roman sestercii. Saoirse had taken me to see the Averni king so that she could show me one truth. But the Morrigan, I suspected, had sent me there so that Aviragus could teach me another. The hazy fog of an idea began to take solid shape in my mind. There was a chance, however slim, that I could redeem myself in the eyes of the goddess and my sister and make something worthwhile out of the whole great mess I had made for myself. I remembered how Saoirse had bargained with Julius Caesar, and I thought that maybe, just maybe, there was more than one way to deal with a demon. Chapter 23. The day before we were due to begin the journey that would take us to our first destination on the circuit tour, Kronos knocked on the door of my quarters and told me that I had a visitor waiting for me in the small garden courtyard. Before I could ask him who it was, he'd gone. But I could think of only one person it might be, Caius. As much as my heart skipped a beat at the mere thought, I wasn't sure I was up to another argument with him, and so I almost didn't go. But I did, and when I stepped into the cool, tree-shaded yard, I was surprised to see that my visitor wasn't Kai, but Charon, the slave trader. To say I was surprised would have been an understatement. My former captor, the man who'd stolen me from my home and then sold me into slavery, sat on a marble bench beneath the branches of a fig tree, carving one of the ripe purple fruits into slices. He popped a slice into his mouth and stood when I approached, a smile lighting his face. He cut another slice of fig and wordlessly offered it to me on the blade of the knife. I took it and sat on the bench facing him.
"Gladiatrix," he said. "It's good to see you again."
I regarded the slave master coolly.
"Is it?"
He laughed softly.
"You are her very mirror, Fallon."
"Whose?"
"Your sister, Saoirse."
He reached for another fig from a low-hanging bough.
She was extraordinary in her arena days, and I understand you're following closely in her footsteps.
Who told you that?
Caius Varro, your sparring partner.
Karin grinned at me.
His father, the senator, entertained me at his domus in the capital 2 nights ago. I politely inquired as to why the lad was wincing with every breath.
I see. I bit into the sweet flesh of the fig and tried to keep my expression neutral.
He seems to believe that you're not very happy with him at the moment, he said. Pity, seeing as how Caius just received orders that he's to escort Caesar's Gladiatrix Corps on the circuit tour. You're going to be seeing a lot of each other.
There was that skip of my heartbeat again.
I have something for you, Gladiatrix.
Charon reached under the bench and hauled out a large wooden box.
I know the Lady Akalia gifted you with Dimakairi swords.
I rolled my eyes at him. One of which she got from you.
Yes. But I also know that you haven't the means to equip yourself with anything else.
He glanced at me as he lifted the box onto the bench between us, and his dark eyes glittered.
On the circuit, you'll be fighting against other gladiatrices who've already won purses. Enough in some cases to kit themselves out head to toe with the best weapons and armor money can buy.
I frowned. It was true. In my time training for the games at the Ludus, it had been made abundantly clear to me that skill was one thing. Showmanship was another. I could fight like the goddess Minerva and perform with all the flourish of the bull-vaulting acrobats I'd heard tales of. But if I didn't look the part, I wouldn't win the crowd. And winning the crowd had become a fierce motivator for me, ever since my visit with Arviragus. I remembered the king's words. It wasn't enough to simply win the fight, I had to win their hearts. I glanced down at the crude leather wrist braces I'd crafted for myself. I don't need charity, I muttered.
Not charity. Patronage.
Charon lifted the lid from the box.
My patronage.
He smiled and handed me a set of greaves, bronze shin guards that were beautiful and made for someone just my size. But that wasn't all. The greaves were matched with a pair of bronze wrist braces, again, sized for my wrists. But the real surprise came when Charon drew forth a magnificent breastplate, embossed with subtle patterns that echoed the knotted, swirling designs of my own tribe. It was studded with bronze fittings in the same style as the greaves and braces. I couldn't contain the gasp of delight that escaped my lips as I reached out and took the breastplate from his hands. My pride warred with my gratitude and my relief, but only for a moment. Wearing such a thing, I would rival not just Minerva, but the Morrigan herself. I held it up in front of me and was surprised to find that it looked as though it would fit me like a second skin. I looked up at Charon from under raised eyebrows. How did you manage to get the proportions so accurate? I asked.
Yes, well, I asked Kai for his help.
The slave master cleared his throat.
He made a best guess, I suppose.
I remembered the sensation of Kai's hands traveling over the lines of my body and felt my face flush with heat. Charon was good enough to pretend not to notice. He turned back to the box and withdrew a battle kilt made of bronze-studded leather straps.
Here. It goes with this.
I hesitated, regarding him suspiciously. Why are you doing this? Charon took the armor back from me and laid it gently in the box. He closed the lid and, after a long moment of silence, slid the box toward me with a sigh.
I traveled with Caesar's legions when he invaded Britannia, Charon said quietly, to assess the slave prospects.
I felt myself grow very still as he spoke.
Sorsha. I saw her for the first time in Caesar's camp, in his tent, and I loved her the moment my eyes met hers. I still do.
He held up a hand.
And nothing ever came of it. Nothing ever will. I came to terms with that a long time ago, Fallon.
She never even tried to come home, I blurted out, the old hurt surfacing like a toothache. She could have at least sent word.
To what end? Charon said gently. Your sister Sorsha is no more. And Akalia belongs to Caesar, who will never let her go. She's far too valuable to him. How would the torment of knowing that his daughter was alive be any kinder to you and your father than letting you both think she was dead?
My head spun. All I could picture in my mind was my heartbroken father sitting night after night in front of the banked embers of the fire in his hearth, drinking slowly from a great mug of ale late into the night, his gaze roaming the shadows of his hall as if seeking her out. All I could think of was that he'd made the decision to marry me off to Aiden because he didn't want to lose me like he'd lost her. I looked at Charon and saw that his dark gaze was also clouded with memory.
My love for Sorsha is an old, scarred over wound on my heart. The ache dulled by the passage of time. Finding you ripped that wound open again. I knew there was something about you from the first moment.
He shook his head.
Then I found your sword, and seeing Sorsha's mark on the blade confirmed it. By then, it was too late to let you go. So I decided that the best thing I could do was bring you here, to her.
And sell me to my own sister for enormous sums of money.
I might be a romantic, Charon grinned wryly, but I'm also a businessman.
Does Sorsha know how you feel? I asked. Does she know you're in love with her?
She didn't. Not at first.
He looked at me and his gaze sharpened noticeably.
Not until I tried to buy her slave contract. From Caesar.
You don't know my sister very well, I said. She could never love someone who owned her like livestock.
No, and that's why I love her. But you misunderstand me, Fallon. I could never own Sorsha, Charon said. The moment her contract was in my hands, I would have torn it to pieces.
You would have. I frowned at the slave master in confusion.
Of course I would have, he snorted. And so would Caius Varro.
Up until that very moment, the legalities of Roman contracts had been a bit lost on me. I suppose I'd never even considered that a contract, once it was written into existence, could simply be torn and made worthless by whoever held the paper. Charon shook his head.
I'm assuming Caius made an offer to buy your contract. Don't tell me you actually think Caius wanted to own you.
But that was exactly what I had thought. Kai. I blinked hard, remembering the anguish in Kai's face as he'd begged me to let him buy my contract. I hadn't understood what he intended to do with it, and he hadn't understood why I wouldn't let him grant my freedom. Instead, we had let our tempers get the best of us, never bothering to figure out the true meaning of our words. I rose to my feet. I needed to find Kai and explain.
Charon stopped me before I could leave. One more thing.
He reached into the leather scrip that hung from his belt and handed me a small vellum scroll, sealed with a blob of black wax. The wax seal was imprinted with a sigil of some kind. I glanced at it, and then back up at him. I can't read this, I said.
I know, he smiled and pressed the scroll back toward me. That's not for you to read.
Then what is it?
It's for you to keep, as payment for a kindness done.
Charon chuckled at the expression on my face.
You've made me a lot of money, Fallon, and not just on your own sale. The price your sister paid for you will serve to goad others on to pay similarly for my wares in the future. It's all in the perception of things. You've guaranteed me money I wouldn't have made had you not helped me rescue the trunk that bore your own sword. That was the proof of your identity, and the only reason I made that kind of profit on your sale. I'm not blind to the irony of the situation.
He ran his hand over the lid of the box of armor. Once outside the walls of the Ludus, you won't be safe. Kai will do his best to look after you, but the ways of Rome and Romans are still foreign to you. And you, Fallon, being you will draw attention, not all of it benign. You'll need to be careful, and you'll need to curb your, what should I call it, your impulsive nature. That scroll, he continued, is for you to use only if you happen to find yourself in a bad situation with no avenue of escape. I plucked at the edge of the scroll's black wax blob with a fingernail. Leave it sealed, Charon said, reaching to cover my hand with his. What is it? I asked, frowning. Some kind of magic? He laughed a little. Of a sort, I suppose. It's a promise.
Of what?
Money. I felt my mouth twist in a sour grimace.
Does it always have to come back to that? I asked.
It's the kind of magic that appeals to most Romans. He squeezed my hand once and let go. Keep this safe and hidden, and keep it with you at all times when you leave the grounds of the Ludus. And if you ever find yourself in need, dire need, mind, give that scroll to whoever it is that threatens you. Unless they hold the wealth of Caesar himself in their hands, I promise this will save you from almost any peril. It guarantees substantial payment upon the safe delivery of your person to my house.
I sat there stunned by the generosity of his gifts. Charon was a man who bought and sold souls, and yet his own soul was a slave to the love he had for my sister. I thought again about Kai's offer to buy my contract. Charon seemed to almost sense what I was thinking. He reached out and tapped a finger on the iron ring I still wore around my neck.
When I put this on you, Fallon, I never meant for it to be permanent.
The slave master stood and nodded a bow to me. Then he turned and left me sitting there in Sorsha's garden, wondering about the invisible armor and shackles that love could bind around a heart. When I returned to my cell after the evening meal, I noticed that someone had been in my room. It would have been hard not to notice. The familiar shadows dancing on the bare stone walls looked wrong. They were thick and tinged with crimson. I squinted through the gloom and sucked in a sharp breath when I saw my oath lamp. In my absence, the brightly colored panes had turned black, reducing the flame within to a muted, reddish gleam. For a moment, I wondered if the huntress moon had transformed the delicate glass meadow bird into one of the Morrigan's battle ravens. It perched there at my window, waiting for me, belly full of the wandering fires of dead souls. Stop it. The Morrigan is your ally, not your enemy. I strode across the room, lifting the guttering lamp down. This was no magical transformation. Someone had rubbed the thing with a coating of the sticky black pine tar we used on the chariot horse's hooves. I could smell the pungent tang of it as soon as I picked up the lamp. Another prank, or a threat, or a warning. As I turned with the lamp in my hand, the lurid glow it cast revealed that the wall above my bed was covered in dripping black scrawls, words and pictures, calling me a Roman lover. At least that's what I politely interpreted as their meaning. I couldn't read the words, but the images were plain enough. The threat was clear. Someone at the Ludus knew about me and Kai. I had to be more careful. If Sorsha found out there was actually something between us, she might very well bar me from the arena. That in itself was worrying enough. But then I saw the bird. Arching above the vile pictures was a crudely rendered raven, with wide black wings and a huge, sharp beak frozen open in a silent shriek. Definitely a warning. I lit the wick of an old tallow candle and blew out the flame in the defiled lamp. Turning my back on the wall, I sat down on the edge of my bed and began, painstakingly, to clean away the soot-black stains from the oath lamp with a strip of linen. As I worked, I whispered a prayer of thanks to the Morrigan,
that I'd had the foresight to take the box of Charon's armor directly to the quartermaster, to be stowed along with my swords in one of the caravan wagons. I hated to imagine what might have happened had I left it in my room. I would need my gear in pristine condition. Because now, more than ever, I was determined to make my mark on the circuit. They thought they could frighten me with pictures painted in tar upon my walls. The pictures I drew would be in the sands of the arena, rendered in my rival's blood, and the letters I carved with my sword, they would spell out victory.
Chapter 24. Charon's welcome gift of armor marked me as a contender, and went a long way toward convincing the crowd I was worthy to be in that arena. But ultimately, my reputation, such as it was to become, was sealed with the outcome of my very first circuit bout, the bout that would forever brand me as the Fury Killer. The Ludus Aquileia's traveling train had set out early through the gates of the compound, and there was an almost festival atmosphere as the girls and our handlers set off down the road, heading northeast into the Umbrian countryside. Our first performance venue on the circuit was in the town of Perugia. As the sun set, we made camp outside the walls of the town. We would sleep that night in tents kept under guard by our escort, Decurion Caius Varro, and a dozen or so of his men. As the stars began to flicker to life in the darkening sky above us, I spotted Kai near Sorsha's tent, speaking to his men. He turned suddenly, as if he'd sensed me watching him. I felt a wave of heat wash over me as he stared at me across the distance. Even through the veils of smoke and sparks from the campfires, I thought I saw a raw longing in his gaze. There must have been something like that in mine too, but then I remembered the ugly pictures and words scrawled over my room. Roman lover. I quickly tore my eyes away. I heard Elka chuckling.
"Little fox," she said. "You escaped from a cage once already. And love. The old crones of my tribe would tell you. Forges cage bars stronger than iron. Maybe don't push your luck, yeah?"
Love. No. Oh, no. I tried to tell her she was being ridiculous, but when I opened my mouth, nothing came out. Elka shook her head and clapped me on the shoulder before retiring to our tent for the night. I should have followed. I was tired, and most of the other girls were already chasing sleep. I watched Elka go and turned back to where Kai still stood staring at me. We hadn't spoken since the infirmary, since I'd cracked Kai's rib and, perhaps even more painful to him, if Charon was to be believed, rejected his offer to buy my contract for a second time. I thought of Mal, and how I'd pushed him away so that I could chase glory in my father's warband. I didn't want to repeat that terrible mistake, not with Caius Varro. In the distance, I could hear the muted whine and ring of metal grinding on stone. Beyond the boundary of our camp, the Ludus weapons masters had set up a tent and would be busy, deep into the night, cleaning and sharpening swords and spears in preparation for the next day. The sound was a lullaby for a gladiatrix, but I was wide awake. I stood and threaded my way between the glowing circles of the fire pits.
"Decurion," I said quietly when I reached him, "may I ask you to accompany me outside the camp?"
Kai stepped away from his fellow soldiers, his gaze questioning, but he nodded.
"Of course, gladiatrix."
We walked silently side by side to the camp entrance, where a Ludus guard straightened at our approach and nodded respectfully first to Kai, then to me.
"I need to pay a visit to the weapons tent," I said to him. "I'll be brief."
He glanced at Kai and then moved aside. The dew-wet grass brushed my bare calves as I walked the short distance to the entrance of the tent. The canvas walls glowed golden from the fire within, and I could smell the tang of metal and wood wafting on the night breeze.
"Oro,"
I greeted the master smith.
I beg a favor.
He straightened up from the freshly sharpened spear blade he was attaching to a wooden shaft and grunted a query at me. A genius with metal. He hoarded his words like gold. I lifted a hand to the iron slave collar that circled my neck. Please, I said, an unexpected knot in my throat. Take this off. Oro's eyes gleamed in the firelight, and he muttered something behind his singed beard that might have been,
about bloody time.
He went to fetch his tools, and Kai stepped up behind me, gently gathering my hair off my shoulders and lifting it out of the smith's way as he worked. I held my breath, and it was over in an instant. The bolt holding the ring together fell away, and Oro pried the ends of the iron open, sliding it from around my neck. I let my breath out in a gasp, and took the collar when he offered it to me. Thank you, I said. He waved us away, turning back to the spear he'd been working on. I pushed the tent flap aside and Kai and I stepped back out into the darkness. The stars overhead seemed brighter somehow. Take it, I said, holding the collar out to Kai. He wrapped his long fingers around the broken iron circle and looked at me, uncertainty in his eyes. Consider it a promise, I said, wrapping my hand around his. I understand now why you wanted to buy my contract. He shook his head. I never wanted to own you, Fallon. Only free you.
I know,